In the spirit of reconciliation, Herbert Smith Freehills acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Hi everyone, I'm Michael Vrasakis, a partner in the Herbert Smith Freehills Financial Services team. Welcome to our podcast series called the FSR GPS. This series focuses on topical and emerging issues in financial services regulation, which we think are the most strategic and important issues for our clients. Feel free to suggest topics you would like us to cover in the future, but for now, we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hi, I'm Abby Sutherland, a solicitor in our financial services team at HSF. I'm joined by partners Michael Vrasakis and Andrew Eastwood, who each specialise in financial services. Thank you both for joining me today.
Hi, Abby. Good to be with you.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Today, we thought we would have a chat about the recent judgment in ASIC and RM Capital, in which the Federal Court determined that the financial services licensee, RM Capital, failed to take reasonable steps to ensure its authorised representative, the SMSF Club, did not receive conflicted remuneration in breach of Section 963F of the Corporations Act. This is the first time a court has considered the construction of Section 963F, so we thought it'd be useful to discuss what Justice Jackson said about what that section requires and consider whether the decision has any broader impacts. First, by way of background, it is worth mentioning that the SMSF Club was authorised under RM Capital's licence to provide financial product advice about self-managed super funds to retail clients. One of the key facts in the case was that RM Capital was aware of and approved, monitored and endorsed a referral agreement between the club and another company that provided for the payment of certain referral fees to the club, which were potentially conflicted remuneration, although RM Capital denied that they were. Michael, to kick us off, what do you think are the key points of interest in this case?
Well, thanks, Abby. I mean, just as a starting point, the judgment clearly sheds light on both ASIC's and the court's view of what steps the licensee should have taken to meet the obligation in 963F. ASIC had argued that RM Capital should have had a conflicts policy that explained and prohibited the acceptance of conflicted remuneration, as well as procedures to review and approve agreements under which the representatives might have received conflicted remuneration, and a compliance program that involved appropriate training of representatives and monitoring of their compliance. And Justice Jackson accepted this. His Honour also held that a licensee in RM Capital circumstances, which included knowledge of matters that gave rise to the risk that the SMSF Club was accepting conflicted remuneration, and this is a really interesting point, would have and should have obtained legal advice on whether the referral agreement involved conflicted remuneration. Now, on one view, you know, conflicted remuneration is a quite technical area, so you can see the validity of that statement by Justice Jackson in terms of the obtaining of legal advice. What's interesting is that His Honour said that the requirement to take reasonable steps does not require the licensee to take every reasonable step that could have been taken, and just pausing at that juncture, that seems very logical. Rather, the question of precisely what to do rests with the licensee, provided that, and I think Andrew's going to say something about this a little bit later, provided that what is done is objectively reasonable. And one can understand, again, the validity of that point. It can't be just something that's subjective. But His Honour also stated that what is objectively reasonable depends on relevant circumstances. And I'm going to say a bit about that actually a little later. But that includes the licensee's knowledge and the known characteristics of the relevant representatives. So you can see there's a real contextual and fact and factual background to and lens through which you've got to view those the reasonable steps obligations. So in this case, the reasonable steps set out by Justice Jackson were directly impacted by the fact that RM Capital were aware of, but it also approved and endorsed the relevant referral agreement.
Thanks, Michael. That seems consistent, I think, with a trend we've been seeing in other cases, do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it was a really logical and useful judgment. It was stepped out with a high degree of logic, and it provides a lot of valuable illumination. But the point, and this point is relevant to 963F in particular, but also other Chapter 7 obligations that require licensees to take reasonable steps. And there are a number of those. For example, the obligation in Section 961L of the Corps Act, which requires licensees to take reasonable steps to ensure that representatives comply with the best interest duty and other personal advice obligations. So, for example, in ASIC versus AMP, the court said in relation to 961L that if the licensee is aware of the risk of non-compliance by specific representatives, the relevant steps are likely to be specific to that representative. There's an earlier case in the federal court that emphasised that breaching the reasonable steps obligation can occur independently of an actual contravention by the relevant representative. So in that sense, they are, whilst they're dependent, they're not totally interdependent. So it also underscores the importance of the review of representatives' conduct being comprehensive and timely. The court did tacitly acknowledge that detectability of misconduct can be a legitimizing factor, i.e. how detectable is the misconduct. The point is that I guess the concept of reasonable steps is quite malleable, and it can depend on the circumstance of the licensee, the relevant representatives and other factors, including the nature of the financial service or financial product being distributed and the target client base, not surprisingly. But this is also relevant to other obligations, such as the general obligation to take reasonable steps to ensure representatives comply with financial services law, as well as the obligation in the DDO context to take reasonable steps to ensure retail product distribution is consistent with a relevant target market determination. So it's also important, I guess, to mark this decision along the spectrum of different formulations that exist from a legal perspective. And you'll see a number of those different formulations used in the license obligations, the licensee obligations and the Corporations Act. So you've got reasonable steps, all reasonable steps, necessary steps, each of which impose different distinguishable legal and practical tests.
Thanks, Michael. Andrew, do you think the case changes what licensees need to do to meet reasonable steps, obligations like the one in Section 963F of the Corps Act? Is it a significant change, do you think?
Abby, I don't think the case involves a significant change. I mean, it does provide helpful clarification, of course, subject to the important point that Michael's already made about the concept of reasonable steps being malleable. In terms of the helpful guidance, I mean, in particular, Justice Jackson makes some general comments in respect of what's required in order to meet an obligation to take steps to ensure that something is not done. His Honour suggested that an organisation with that kind of role should at least state clearly its position on the matter, communicate that position to new recruits, not give its authorisation to the promotion of or advice in relation to a product without checking that the product does not involve conflicted remuneration, follow through if the check gives cause for concern, periodically remind representatives about the existence and content of the prohibition, and then check to see whether it's being breached. And it's likely that many of those steps will also be relevant to a licensee's ability to meet other reasonable steps obligations. Justice Jackson also made the point that the degree of difficulty and practicality of any given steps and their costs are relevant considerations in working out what's reasonable, but there's a limit to how far you can take that. His Honour said that the importance of the goal that Section 963F seeks to achieve of preventing the acceptance of conflicted remuneration and its focus on protecting retail clients means that steps that result in significant cost, inconvenience, or difficulty to a licensee may still be reasonable ones. So it's not going to be a complete answer for a licensee to say, oh, this particular step would have been expensive for us to undertake.
Yeah, I think that's right. Thanks, Andrew. Michael, what do you think about the interaction between obligations such as 963F and the efficiently, honestly, and fairly obligation in section 912A1A?
That's a good question, Abby. I think it's worth pointing out that there is a difference in terms of the standard of conduct, because whilst the obligation to take reasonable steps to ensure representatives do not accept conflict of remuneration is a serious one, which, as Andrew has mentioned, may in some circumstances require inconvenient steps to be taken, it does involve a lower standard than the efficiently, honestly and fairly obligation. That obligation to act efficiently, honestly and fairly in the provision of financial service under section 912A1A of the Corporations Act uses that higher formulation requiring a licensee to do all things necessary to ensure that the financial services covered by the license are provided efficiently, honestly and fairly. So all things necessary, just adding that emphasis. Whilst it has been held that the EHF obligation does not require absolute perfection, it's clearly a more onerous standard, and it is in fact the most onerous of that spectrum of obligations I mentioned earlier around reasonable steps versus necessary steps. I think when you look at sort of these types of obligations and put them together, it is conceivable the licensee could breach both the obligation in section 963F, that specific obligation in relation to conflict of remuneration, but also the EHF obligation, for example, where they fail to put in place reasonable policies and procedures to prevent representatives accepting conflict of remuneration. So often ASIC will assert breaches of multiple provisions of the Corporations Act, as we know, including the omnipresent misleading deceptive conduct, but more specifically from other more comparable cases we've seen, the courts have been interpreting the EHF obligation as a forward-looking provision, which requires licensee to take steps to achieve compliance before any specific instance of non-compliance has arisen.
Thanks, Michael. Andrew, in terms of evidentiary requirements, what do licensees need to do to establish they have taken reasonable steps?
Yeah, thanks, Abby. Yeah, I think this point about evidence is really an important lesson from the RM Capital case. I guess I'll mention a few examples of why I say that. As part of its asserted reasonable steps, as part of its defence, RM Capital sought to rely on the fact that it had a stringent policy that its authorised representatives had to undertake a certain number of hours of training each year. That's good so far as it goes, but when the actual evidence was considered, there was no record or register who actually attended training. Further, when the content of the training was analysed, it wasn't apparent that the training actually covered the topic of conflicted remuneration in any detail. Another example is monitoring. RM Capital sought to rely as part of its reasonable steps on it having a practice of auditing the records of authorised representatives periodically. Again, that would be an important aspect of reasonable steps, but again, the evidence didn't really support the contention. As to the content of audits performed, the evidence didn't establish that the audits included checking whether conflicted remuneration was received. And in the case of SMNSF Club, the evidence showed that over the relevant period, only a very small number of reviews or audits of the club's files were undertaken. I could give other examples, but the key point is that if a licensee finds itself the subject of an ASIC investigation or worse still, a court proceeding, it's just not going to be enough to assert that the licensee has policies and procedures and conducts audits and reviews and conducts training and the like. The licensee is actually going to have to prove by admissible evidence, preferably via documents, what has occurred.
Mm. Thanks, Andrew. Michael, do you think there are different thresholds for assessing when a licensee should report a breach of a more technical provision like section 963F? And general conduct obligations like the requirement to take reasonable steps to ensure representatives comply with 912A. Do you think there's a difference in how licensees should approach the analysis in these situations?
Thanks, Abby. I think that the relevant issue here, the most relevant issue, is that the case makes it really clear that reasonable steps and the reasonable steps yardstick that you need to apply are going to depend on the factual setting. And I think by the same logic, they undoubtedly will depend on the statutory context. So to your earlier point, it may well depend on the severity of the provision, the offence, and the requirements that are specified specifically in the statute. But broadly speaking, all these obligations that you mentioned are standards of conduct, and the legislature has chosen reasonableness as that statutory yardstick. It should follow logically that what constitutes reasonable steps will be determined by this yardstick of reasonableness. And reasonableness, I mean, there's a malleability factor, which we've talked about, but I think there's one really important point, additional point to make, and that is that, as you see in areas like negligence of what's reasonable, the yardstick of reasonableness in this context, in this statutory context, undoubtedly can evolve, and it will evolve through the medium of community expectations, which is a real kind of catch cry of the courts and obviously stem from the Royal Commission, but also other important factors such as improvements in technology may well affect that standard of reasonableness. And of course, there's always what courts find in future comparable cases, as the courts give guidance, that can in turn affect the concept of reasonableness and how licensees need to interpret it going forward.
Definitely. And for the last word, Andrew, any thoughts on this standard of reasonableness?
Well, Abby, I think reasonableness is somewhat in the eyes of the beholder. It's important for licensees to appreciate that the test under 963F and similar provisions is objective. So it isn't answered by what the licensee thinks is reasonable. It isn't a gold-plated standard or a standard of perfection, but at the same time, as we've discussed, just because particular steps may be difficult or costly to the licensee doesn't mean that they aren't reasonable. I think the unfortunate aspect of any reasonableness standard in the law is that there just aren't black and white lines. The assessment in any particular case will be fact dependent. But as we've discussed, this decision in RM Capital does give us some helpful guidance as to the kinds of steps that ASIC and a court are likely to look for.
Thank you very much, Andrew and Michael, for your insights. And thank you to the listeners for joining us today.
Thanks, Abby.
You have been listening to a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. For more episodes, please go to our channel on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud, and visit our website, herbertsmithfreehills.com, for more insights relevant to your business.